Have you ever stared at a sectional chart with your route drawn in pencil, your navigation log half finished, and realized you have no idea what altitude to put in that little box at the top? I'm Pattern on Traffic Pattern, here on Radio Hangar, and this one trips up more student pilots than you'd think. Choosing your cruising altitude on a VFR cross-country sounds simple. Pick a number, fly there, done, but that number affects everything. Your ground speed, your fuel burn, your time on route. Whether you can even see the ground, whether you arrive with full reserves or fumes, and on your check ride, the examiner will want to know why you picked that altitude, not just that you picked one. So let's walk through this together, because there's a method to it, and once you understand the trade-offs, you'll never just guess again. Shout out to our friends at aviationsoul.com. They make challenge coins for every step of the journey. Got your first solo? There's a coin for that. Private pilot. Instrument? Commercial? They've got you covered. Great way to mark the milestones that matter. AviationSoul.com. All right, let's start with the rule, because there is one, and it's not optional. Federal Aviation Regulation 91.159, if you're flying more than 3,000 feet above the surface, you need to follow the hemispheric rule. Magnetic course, 0 through 179, you fly at odd thousands plus 500. That's 3,500, 5,500, 7,500. Magnetic course, 180 through 359, even thousands plus 500. 4,500, 6,500, 8,500. Now notice I said magnetic course, not heading. That's a detail the examiner loves. Your course is the line you drew on the chart, corrected for magnetic variation, not your heading, which also includes wind correction. A lot of students mix those up, and it matters, because the hemispheric rule is based on the direction you're traveling, not the direction your nose is pointing. And below 3,000 feet above the ground, no hemispheric rule applies. You can fly any altitude you want, as long as you meet the minimum safe altitude requirements under FAR 91.119. But here's the thing. Just because you can fly at 2,500 feet doesn't mean you should. Let's talk about why. The first factor is terrain and obstacles. Pull out your sectional. Look at your route. What's the highest terrain along the way? What's the highest obstacle? The sectional shows maximum elevation figures in each quadrangle, those big numbers in the latitude-longitude grid squares. That gives you the highest known feature rounded up, including terrain and obstructions. Your cruising altitude needs to clear all of that with a comfortable margin. 1,000 feet of clearance over the highest obstacle within 5 miles of your route is a reasonable minimum for daytime VFR, and the ACS expects you to plan a safe altitude, not just a legal one. Here's something I wish someone told me when I was training. Don't just look at the terrain along your pencil line. Look 5 or 10 miles either side of it, because you're going to drift. The wind is going to push you. You might divert around weather or a restricted area. If the terrain 5 miles left of your course is 1,500 feet higher than what's directly beneath your route, you need to know that before you're looking at it through the windscreen. Second factor, wind. This is the big one, and it's where the real decision-making lives. You've pulled the winds and temperatures aloft forecast. You've got wind direction and speed at 3,000, 6,000, 9,000, 12,000. Now here's the question every cross-country plan has to answer. Where's the best wind? If you're flying east and the winds at 6,000 are from the west at 25 knots, that's a tailwind. Beautiful. You'll get there faster, burn less fuel, and arrive with more reserve. But if those same winds at 3,000 are from the south at 10 and your course is east, that's almost a direct crosswind. Not as helpful, but also not hurting you as much as a headwind. Now flip the scenario. You're heading west. Those 6,000-foot winds are now a 25-knot headwind. Your 110-knot Cessna 172 just became an 85-knot Cessna 172 over the ground. Your 2-hour flight just became 2.5 hours. That's an extra half hour of fuel burn you might not have budgeted for. So what do? You look at the lower altitudes. Maybe at 3,500 feet, the wind is lighter. Maybe it's only 10 knots on the nose instead of 25. You'll lose some true airspeed because you're lower and the air is denser. But the ground speed math might still work in your favor. Run the numbers. Use your E6B or your electronic flight calculator. Compare the ground speed at each legal altitude and pick the one that gets you there most efficiently. And this is where the examiner's ears perk up. They want to hear you explain the reasoning, not just I picked 5,500. They want I picked 5,500 because the winds at 6,000 were a 20-knot headwind, but at 4,000 the terrain along my route requires at least 4,500 for safe clearance, and the winds at 3,000 were only 8 knots on the nose, so 5,500 gives me both terrain clearance and a manageable headwind. That answer will make an examiner smile. Third factor, cloud clearance and visibility. You're flying VFR, which means you need to stay clear of clouds by specific distances. In controlled airspace, class echo above 1,200 feet, that's 1,000 feet above, 500 feet below, and 2,000 feet horizontally from any cloud, with 3 statute miles visibility. If the ceiling is reported at 5,000 broken, and you want to cruise at 4,500, you've only got 500 feet between you and the cloud bases. That's your minimum below clearance, sure, but is it comfortable? Probably not. One updraft, one terrain rise, and you're in the soup. Here's the practical reality. The legal minimum is not the same as the smart minimum. If the ceiling is at 5,000, I'd much rather be at 3,500 with 1,500 feet of breathing room than at 4,500 with my head brushing the bottoms of the clouds. You can see the terrain better, you can maneuver more freely, and if conditions deteriorate, you have more time to react. Check the weather along your entire route, not just at your departure and destination. The ceiling at your home airport might be clear, but what about the valley 60 miles out where the terrain rises and the clouds compress? A ceiling that's fine at sea level can become a very tight squeeze when the ground rises underneath it. Fourth factor, aircraft performance. Your airplane performs differently at different altitudes, and this matters more than most students realize. As you climb, the air gets thinner. Your engine produces less power. Your propeller is less efficient, but your true airspeed increases because you're moving through less dense air. So there's a sweet spot, an altitude where the gain in true airspeed balances against the loss in engine performance and the fuel required to get up there. For most normally aspirated training aircraft, that sweet spot is somewhere between 4,000 and 8,000 feet, depending on the airplane. In a Cessna 172, you'll often find that 7,500 or 8,500 gives you the best true airspeed for a given power setting. But here's the catch. If your trip is only 80 miles, spending 15 or 20 minutes climbing to 8,500 eats up a significant portion of your flight. You burn more fuel climbing than cruising. The time you spend going up might negate the speed advantage you gain once you're there, rule of thumb. If your flight is under about 100 miles, lower altitudes are usually more efficient because you spend less time in fuel climbing. If your flight is over 150 miles, climbing higher can pay off because you'll cruise at a faster true airspeed for a longer portion of the trip. And don't forget about fuel burn rates at altitude. Check your pilot's operating handbook. Your POH will show you fuel consumption at different altitudes and power settings. A lot of students plan fuel burn at the sea level rate and then wonder why their numbers don't match reality. At higher altitudes, you're typically leaning the mixture, which reduces fuel burn, but you have to actually lean it. If you climb to 7,500 and leave the mixture full rich, you're wasting fuel and running the engine inefficiently. Fifth factor, and this one's subtle. Turbulence and comfort. Low altitudes on a hot summer afternoon are a roller coaster. Thermal turbulence builds from late morning through mid-afternoon as the sun heats the ground. Flying at 2,500 feet over dark plowed fields on a July day will rattle your teeth and your passengers. Climb to 5,500 or 6,500 and it often smooths out considerably. Conversely, sometimes the winds aloft at higher altitudes introduce mechanical turbulence, especially near mountain ridges or frontal boundaries. The pilot reports the PIREPs are your best friend here. If pilots ahead of you are reporting moderate turbulence at 6,000, maybe 4,500 is the better call even if the wind isn't ideal. And think about your passengers. If you've got 3 people in the back who've never been in a small airplane, a smooth ride matters. Sometimes the best altitude on paper isn't the best altitude for the humans in the cabin. Now, let me put all of this together with a real planning scenario. Because this is how it actually works at the kitchen table the night before your cross-country. Let's say you're planning a flight from an airport near sea level to another airport 140 miles to the southwest. Your magnetic course works out to about 220 degrees. That means you need an even altitude plus 500. So your options are 4,500, 6,500, or 8,500. You pull the winds and temperatures aloft. At 3,000 winds are from 270 at 15. At 6,000 winds are from 280 at 25. At 9,000 winds are from 290 at 35. Your course is 220, Wind from 270 at 3000 means the wind is coming from about 50 degrees to the right of your nose. That's partly a headwind and partly a crosswind. When you run the numbers, your headwind component at 3000 is about 10 knots, and your crosswind is about 12 knots. At 6000 wind from 280, that's 60 degrees off your nose. Headwind component is about 12 knots, crosswind is about 22 knots. More crosswind correction needed, and slightly more headwind. At 9000 wind from 290, 70 degrees off your nose. Headwind component drops to about 12 knots, but crosswind jumps to 33 knots, and you'd spend more time and fuel climbing, so the winds favor the lower altitude. 4500 gives you the smallest headwind component and the least crosswind correction. Now check the terrain. You look at the sectional and the maximum elevation figures along your route. The highest is 2200 feet. 4500 gives you 2300 feet of clearance. Comfortable. Now check the weather. The TAF at your destination says ceiling broken at 6000. Along the route, the area forecast mentions scattered clouds at 4500. That's a problem. Scattered means 3/8 to 4/8 sky coverage. You might be weaving between cloud layers at 4500, and maintaining your VFR cloud clearances could get difficult. So you bump up to 6500, the headwind is a bit worse, the crosswind is a bit more, but you've got clear air above the scattered layer and plenty of room below the broken layer at 6000. You recalculate your ground speed, adjust your fuel burn, and update your navigation log. That is the process. Terrain, wind, weather, performance, comfort. You weigh them against each other, pick the best compromise, and then you can explain exactly why you chose that altitude to anyone who asks. One more thing. Your altitude choice isn't permanent. This is something students forget. You planned 6,500, but 20 minutes into the flight, you notice the clouds are lower than forecast and you're getting uncomfortable. Or the wind at 6,500 is stronger than predicted. You can descend. You can change your plan. The altitude on your navigation log is your best guess before departure. The altitude you actually fly is a decision you make in real time based on what you're seeing out the window and hearing from flight service. The best cross-country pilots are the ones who plan carefully and then stay flexible. They treat the plan as a starting point, not a contract. The examiner is looking for exactly that kind of thinking on your check ride. Not perfection. Not the one right answer. They want to see a logical process. They want to know you considered the factors, made a reasoned choice, and that you're willing to change it when the situation changes. This content draws from the FAR AIM, the Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge, and the Private Pilot Airman Certification Standards, all things you should have bookmarked by now. That's all for this one. Go pull a Winds Aloft forecast tonight and run the numbers at two different altitudes for a route you've been wanting to fly. You'll be surprised how much that one decision changes. I'm Pattern, and I'll see you in the traffic pattern. RadioHangar.com.